Liz Grossman.
I'm Rachel Gilman-Rischel.
And I'm Molly Each. You're listening to the Between Bites podcast, a nonprofit food-inspired storytelling series. We feature first-person stories from chefs, restaurateurs, writers, and others in the food and drink industry. Episodes are recorded live in Chicago bars and restaurants. We hope you enjoy.
Our next reader is a graduate of Johnson & Wales who moved to Chicago to work as the pastry sous chef of True under Gail Gand. From there, she went on to Charlie Trotter's Kitchen, where she met her husband, John, and the two left Chicago to open Townhouse in rural Virginia. After 4 years and glowing New York Times accolades, they came back to Chicago to open the now two Michelin-starred Smith and The Loyalist, where she serves as co-owner and executive pastry chef. Please welcome Karen Uri Shields.
When a friend of mine asked me to do this, the first thought that came to mind was, no one is going to know who I am, or are they really going to care about a story that I might have to tell? Which also really translated into, I don't want to go on stage in front of 100 people and talk in front of a microphone. So here I had a fear of talking to a crowd and a perfectly viable excuse. No one will know me. Done. The answer is no, thank you. Then the angel on my shoulder gave me a nudge and said, read between the lines here, Karen. This is quintessentially what Uprooted is. I realized how this one single word really does sum me and my story up pretty well. A vision, a passion, unwavering, relentlessness, anxiety, sleepless nights, chaos, panic attacks, manic depressiveness, insecurity, self-doubt, it goes on and on and on. Grit, goals, and a big picture, all lessons that we try to teach our kids on a daily basis. So here goes. At the 11th hour in high school, I decided I wanted to go to culinary school, literally thumbing through a giant book of colleges that was divided by state. I came across Rhode Island. Who goes to Rhode Island and what's in Rhode Island? How totally random. And I love the sheer idea of that. I love random. Turns out I like the road less traveled, the mysteriousness of taking the unconventional route of a liberal arts education to the level of culinary school. Maybe I chose this just to freak my parents out. Torture them subconsciously for no reason at all, send worry through their veins only to have the opportunity to prove them wrong. Which turns out was one of my skills, arguing and relentlessness. Why didn't I become a lawyer? I will never know. I am the youngest of three in my family, and by the time I came around, my parents were exhausted of parenting. That coupled with my arguing skills means I got away with a lot. My parents were, and still are, supportive in a very non-confrontational way. Maybe the joke is on me. Maybe it was my plan to freak them out, and maybe it was their plan to see me fall flat and learn a really hard lesson. Culinary school? Well, I love to cook. I love to experiment. I've spent my entire childhood and family life devoted to food. But who knew I could make a life of this necessary evil of sustenance? Could I turn cooking and food into a way of life? Turns out yes. Is it an easy way of life? No. But it soon became my normal, and I better embrace it, because little did I know that it would become quite a ride. This food thing soon became an obsession where enough is never enough. I apparently like pain. I seek pain and challenge, which is what I'm feeling right now. This is very painful. It's fine, bring it on. The kitchens where I spent my 10 years all had a common thread. If it's perfect, it'll do. Now, a young girl with body image issues, this would be a recipe for disaster, but for a food addict, this was just the fuel I needed to keep the trajectory going. If it's perfect, it'll do. Never actually achievable, but as a strong-willed individual, I could certainly go for the reach. Uprooting achievable goals, manipulating a common path for the road less traveled would soon become one of my mantras. Uprooting traditional thinking, go for it. what do I have to lose? After 9 years in working in some tough kitchens dominated by the impossible, I had proven something to myself. Day after day, service after service, the world told me I could do it. Somehow, every day, I achieved the seemingly impossible. 200 people a night, no problem. The new hire was a no-call, no-show, no problem. We have a guest who is allergic to all white food and refuses to eat off of white plates. No problem. This is so weird, but real. That's a true story. The oven goes down at 4 p.m. on a Saturday. No problem, we got this. Karen, can you drop what you're doing? It's 7 o'clock on a Saturday night and give these amazing, psyched folks a kitchen tour. No problem, chef, I got it. It goes on and on. Couldn't have done a single thing without my fellow chefs elbow to elbow, all having panic attacks, all feeling the same pain. It was and is a family. The camaraderie will never go away. So 9 years of this, and my now husband and I were ready for the next step. Any logical person would say the position we accepted to be chef and pastry chef at Charlie Trotter's restaurant in Las Vegas was a very rational next step. We accepted we were going to embrace it. A few months into planning, we decided maybe this wasn't right for us. As we visualized our life in Vegas, it seemed unnervingly empty. It felt remarkably cold, confusing, and unbalanced. One of the most uncomfortable situations I was then faced with was to give my notice to Charlie Trotter himself. The untouchable legend, the chef whom I had respected for all these years, regardless of the hardships and regardless of the public persona so many people like to pin him as, he was different to me. I appreciated all of his untimely excellence meetings. I appreciated his attention to detail. I appreciated his passion for the culinary arts. I saw through his less than perfect communication and saw the big picture he was so passionately trying to instill. You either get it or you don't. Nervous, very nervous, I gave my notice. I remember it very clearly to this day. Sitting in the dining room, was he going to blacklist me as a failure? Huge, huge fear of mine. He met me with a smile of support and said, Karen, whatever you do, just go up. So, on that note, Chicago to Chilhowee, here we come. Very logical. Literally uprooted from all modern civilization, we were en route to small town, the bucolic countryside. We had no idea what we were getting into, but we knew we were in it together. As we told our families the news, we were met with silence, support, confusion. My parents, being the silent, non-confrontational types, were quietly supportive. Were they standing back, going to watch me fall? The paranoia soon set in. This was maybe the last straw for my sister. She had to speak up. She researched the little town of 1,800 people only to find out that the sheriff in town was recently being convicted on meth charges and said, Karen! God, are you thinking this through? John and I are headstrong. We were devoted to uprooting our lives literally and figuratively. Not to mention, I had made a promise to Charlie. I was going to make it happen. I had no choice but to go up. Our quest was to find an unadulterated land, a community that had no influence on us, causing insecurity, self-doubt, and chaining our creative freedom. To fast forward this, time in Chilhowee was our aha moment, as Oprah would say. We said, fuck it to conventional wisdom. This was our opportunity to discover who we were as chefs, what cuisine and hospitality meant to us, and that we did. Was it nerve-wracking and uncomfortable? Yes. We were in the middle of Appalachia, a naive, rural, and random place that we now called home. As we peeled back the layers, we found this unadulterated land to be full of positive influences, inspiration, and purple mountains. America the Beautiful soon became my daily theme song on our way to work, and I'm not going to sing it now, but John will attest I sang it every day on the way to work. It was just so fitting. So for 4 years, we honed our craft and said F you to naysayers and came into our skin where we felt confident and comfortable. Comfortable? No. Comfortable is mediocrity. I'm hearing Charlie ring in my voice. Mediocrity is the devil for success. Time to move on. On paper, opening a restaurant was the next logical step. Here I go with logic again. So we thought our name was becoming known amongst the food community. Let's open our own place. Let's set forth on the journey with all the good and the bad we had absorbed on our arduous climb up the totem pole and make it our own. So simple. Nope. Here we were again, uprooted, extremely uncomfortable. Now we had a 6-month-old baby. We had to make our life almost all over again. We had to write plans, we had to prove our dedication all over again. And now, without an umbrella over our heads, we were feeling totally defeated. We were completely exposed. Opening a restaurant was a hard reality, not handed to us on a silver platter. Rather a feat, a fight, and a war at times. We had no choice to give up. That was not an option. It never had been, and it certainly won't be now. A 6-month-old baby, young professionals living with my parents for 3.5 years, honey, I guess, with no light in sight. We were doomed. We had some dreary days. We persevered. We proved to no one but ourselves we can do this. We got this. Duke's up and feisty, pragmatic, yet completely frantic. We decided to have another baby because I said, well, like, there's no time better than now. Let's throw fuel on the fire and let's just get this done now. So now we have 2 babies and we're living with my parents and there's no end in sight. And my mom has pretty much written off John as any sort of reliable type of husband whatsoever, and he would awkwardly cook them dinner and think that he was like offering peace, and it just wasn't working. 4 years, 6 months, and 26 days later, we were open. Smith and the Loyalist was now a reality, a dream turned to true. Done. One milestone accomplished, another yet to begin. So here we are, uprooting on a daily basis, surviving as pain and torture addicts. Just as soon as our dreams become beautiful realities, we uproot, we break it because it's not broken. It's who we are by nature, apparently. Happy and blessed, 2 restaurants, 2 beautiful little girls, and the world as our oyster. So the common thread is to be uncomfortable. Find a different route. It is within uprooting yourself that you will not only see what you are capable of, but your quest for excellence will fruit bounties of personal success. I'm a big fan of uprooting.
Our next reader is the renowned chef and owner of 2 highly regarded restaurants, Lula Cafe in Logan Square and Marisol in the Museum of Contemporary Art. He's also a founding member of an incredible nonprofit called Pilot Light that brings a food-based curriculum to Chicago public schools. Also, while he is best known for his culinary chops, you might not realize that he graduated from Brown with a degree in English and received his Master of Arts from Illinois State University. Please welcome Jason Hamill.
Hi. So, Karen, this story starts in Providence. I planned it that way, just so you know. Story's in 6 parts, so if, like, around part 3, you start to get bored, you only have 3 parts left. So. And it is about a time that I was uprooted, or I uprooted myself, by moving away for 6 months. It's called These Are For Today, part 1. In the summer of 1993, I rented a 1-room apartment in Florence, Italy, with the intention of writing my way out of a broken heart. I was 20 years old. I'd told friends at college that I needed to get away from everyone, though I was really just getting away from the likely chance I'd run into this one particular woman and one particular triumph-riding, French-accented 6-foot adjunct in the architecture department. Why I thought I could rewrite this whole arrangement with the most gratuitously confessional novel in history is one of those pieces of 20-year-old logic that is believable then but absurd now. Thank God I lost those notebooks in a flood. My Italian apartment measured exactly 18 inches wider than a twin bed at its center. In the corner was a triangular table meant more for a plant than a human, and a brutal Van Gogh-ish chair with a straw seat. On the south wall were two closets, one for my kitchen and the other a literal water closet, so small that the facilities were arranged on top of each other, like almost vertically. And to bathe, you'd have to straddle the toilet, turn on the shower, and let the water fall down into the open bowl. Same for the kitchen, a doll's house of miniatures in which an electric hot plate, a melon-sized sink, and a set of worn wooden spoons small as a child's bone all shared the tiny space. It was an unlikely place to learn how to cook. I knew no one in Italy. There was no phone or email. I was not taking a class, not digging for antiquities. I was not an apprentice, or a word I didn't know at the time, a stage. My money was budgeted to something like $8 per diem. I figured I could finish this novel and return to school the following year, having shed this feeling I now had, which had come on slowly, in pace with my stubborn realization of what was happening, but then had somehow lasted. The feeling was in my stomach, like the feeling you get being lost in a crowd as a child. 2. I had not, however, intended on renting an apartment overlooking the central food market. The apartment was not exactly a place for contemplative thought. The Piazza del Mercato Centrale is one of the most noisy, tourist-free spots in the center of town, where outside my window the hours passed in near constant clamor. The day began as a line of small trucks unloaded in the dark and ended in the afternoon as teams of men with wide flat brooms swept rotten bits into the sewers. All day long, scooters, tiny cars, shouting, whistles, horns. I soon realized that shopping for fruits and vegetables was very different in Italy than in the United States. At home, you choose your stuff, you put it in wasteful, hard-to-open plastic baggies yourself, just grab and go. And if you wish, you can squeeze tomatoes, rattle melons, sneak peek at the corn. But here in the Italian market, you were meant to engage with the vendors, most of whom were curmudgeonly man-witches armed with paring knives. And you meant you needed to describe to them what exactly you were looking for, and not just its weight in grams, but also by its purpose, like down to who was coming for dinner and what the occasion was and what actual recipe you'd use. All of this in a loud and confident voice, speaking quickly, because other curmudgeonly shoppers would also be shouting their orders, elbowing and cutting in line, sempre in fretta, always in a rush. I stumbled badly, said asinine things like I wanted a fish when I wanted a peach. Pesce, pesca, found myself pushed to the back like a runt. I made several expensive mispicks. That is, until I met the girl with the figs. It's part 3. For several days, I'd seen her tending her family stall. In a room full of pudgy men, she was an Apollonia, though when I close my eyes and remember, she appears more humble, pretty and shy, more like Diane Keaton, really. She wore pale cardigan sweaters in the mornings, was thin, strong, sharply boned. Just two steps away sat her father on his panopticon stool, swiveling left, right, left in mystical rhythm. He was one of the many in his workman's blue jacket and heavy glasses on a chain, and like the rest, spent his downtime trimming produce into a box lined with communist newspaper. "Good morning," she said as I approached, in English. "Do you like some figs?" "I don't know," I said. "Are they expensive?" "Go ahead, Shelley too," she said, opening a brown paper bag and handing them to me. "You choose. Questi sono per oggi." "These are for today," I said proudly, repeating her. The father raised his brow, closed his knife. "Americano," she said. Carefully, I set two figs inside the bag and passed it back to her. She pointed to some mint bunched upright in a cup of water. I shrugged. "Figs and mint?" She nodded yes. I pointed to sage. She shook her head, gestured toward the sun, then made a fan of the paper bag. She was saying, figs, and mint is for a summer day. From that day on, I visited no other stall but hers. Together, we broke the rules. I was allowed to touch what I wanted and go behind the counter and to put it on the scale, deciding for myself, being myself, not fitting in. She made suggestions for me on what to eat, how to eat it, why one thing needed another. Figs and mint, rosemary for when it rained. Her father looked the other way. Americans come and go. 4. By mid-July, I had become quiet friends with the fruit vendor. Little extras went in my bag without her father noticing. An artichoke, a plum. Here, this goes good together, she'd smile knowingly. Once, coming home with this freakishly good melon against which I have compared every melon in 18 years of professional melon buying, I found the surprise of a few slices of her family's own cured ham. I wrote back home, "You won't believe it. I'm eating melon and prosciutto in my own Italian apartment. The market is right outside my door, and I've made a ritual of going there every day. Miss you." My mother likes to cite this postcard as the origin story of my life as a chef, as though it describes some primordial happiness I am now trying to recapture in the hospitality business. Like this was when I discovered my love for food. But the truth is, I have never been so more full of despair in my life as when I was washing that melon in the tiny sink, all my thoughts falling endlessly, selfishly down to the pit of my stomach, where I felt this like lava. I was alone in there. The melon was no company. Mornings with the notebooks, purposeless afternoon outings in the city, nights back at the desk, weekend visits to churches and nearby towns, all scheduled in such a way to prevent me from losing touch, like with reality, with date and time, news, the fact that there were other people out there living. I passed by the massive Duomo, the Cathedral of Santa Maria, the Brunelleschi Dome, and Giotto's Campanile, the tower of 3 marbles, 7 bells, and 414 steps to the top. I passed these each day without even looking up, on my way to nowhere. The beauty, the history of it had no meaning, no weight at all. I would go home for dinner then, generally to write for another hour or two until the sun went down and people returned to the streets for the evening passeggiata. Everyone walked in pairs for this well-dressed parade of the mated, hands held everywhere. This, the country of passionate, monogamous, deeply sexual Catholic love. Sometimes I'd head up the hill by the Boboli Gardens, where all the streets were lined with cars, with a newspaper covering their windows, the only place young people could find for sex. Car after shaking car, as I walked with my own Italian newspaper under one arm, pretending I was a local on his way home from work. But I was fooling myself, keeping false pace as false pretense, as I walked for aimless hours along the river, the dark, deep lengths of which rushed unseen below me. Bats flew above the black water as I passed on adjacent streets. What if I leapt? Where would they find me? Somewhere down the end of this sweeping stream? I walked to spots from where I imagined one could leap, along the tracks, the overpass of the highway out of town. I stood and I fathomed. What a strange word, a word to measure how far down I'd go. One Friday night for the festival, they kept the campanile open late, and I climbed all 414 steps of the bell tower in a daze and stood out in front of the cityscape, blurrily impressionistic in late summer light. What muscle would move first? Was it something a body could even choose to do? I felt the ancient stone edge with my hand and thought how deep and infinite really this line was between where I was standing now and the fathoms below. It would take only the smallest force to push from where I stood, yet the effort was too vast, the line impassable, the failure too real. To lose your balance, to lose your mind, or just to be lost, a child in a crowd. Will they find me? I turned and walked away. 5. One morning in late August, I took another walk to the edge of town. As usual, I hurried with fake purpose through the streets, able to dodge tourists as they gaped in all directions. Through the main piazza at the Duomo, past the Campanile, a large crowd had gathered around the bell tower, which was undergoing renovations and had scaffolding at its base. There were more people there than I had ever seen before, a crowd at least 10 deep, and they were all silently staring at something. I could not tell what. This corner of the piazza was center stage for all sorts of buskers and dancers and drum lines from Peru, and I remember thinking that they were probably waiting for something like that to begin. I turned down the southwest street and heard sirens behind me. On second thought, maybe someone had been robbed. Then, on my way back home, an hour later, I realized I'd skipped shopping and could just catch the last hour of the market if I rushed. Back at the cathedral, there was still a crowd surrounding the Campanile, though smaller now. Something made me stop. People were crying. A woman held her hand over her mouth as a child twirled blithely in her skirt. From a short distance, I watched as people came up to a police line, newly stretched between blue sawhorses, and spoke with other onlookers, and then had similar reactions, looking up, pointing, then down at the marble and the stone, hands over the mouth, heads shaking. The scaffolding rose 2 stories up the marble exterior to a platform where several policemen stood, just talking, like casually. I stopped at the caution tape but could see nothing, and then a small truck drove through the piazza and was ushered behind the line. In my life, I have never seen another vehicle like it. It was military grade, white, with no identifying writing or symbols at all. On the back were twin tanks of water and high-pressured hoses, both for spraying water and for sucking it back in. 2 men on the truck got out in orange protective suits with gloves and masks, climbed to the top of the scaffolding where the policeman stood, and began to spray the metal bars and catwalk at its top. A 3rd man, down at the bell tower's base, used the vacuum to clean up the water as it ran into streams below. "For love," someone said. "What a waste. A child, really. Just a girl. Earlier today? At 1, just an hour ago. I don't see anyone. Just 17? Again? Twice this year. No, 3 times. I watched the men long enough for them to finish their work and allow another set of men, like the ones I'd see at the market, arrive with their brooms. They swept remaining puddles of water down into the sewer and then left. 6. The market in the afternoon, though empty of patrons, was still a flurry of activity as vendors packed up for the day. I walked up the steel stairs to the breezy 2nd floor. At my usual stall, no one was there. Green tarps had been laid over the vegetables to protect them from the birds. Since I knew where she kept the paper bags, I helped myself to one and shook it open, peeked under the tarp. A pint of small black-red cherry tomatoes looked so good, I put them in my bag. "Hey, you over there, you!" I looked over. At first I thought it was the father, his eyeglasses down to the edge of his nose, but it was another man pointing an open pocket knife at me. "Thief! What are you doing? I'll call the police." That this was all in Italian didn't matter. For the first time, I understood what he said without even translating the words. In that moment, 10 or more people encircled me. I held up the bag in a meek display of honesty and sought to explain myself, but could not speak in either language. "Put that back, now!" I obeyed, and as I did, the young woman and her father appeared from around the corner. She ran to me and started speaking rapidly to the man with the knife. "It's him, the American. He comes every day. Like, leave him alone. He buys things every day." And then the mob disappeared fast as they'd come. The father, with a huff, sat down on his stool and spun away from us. "Thank you," I said. The woman picked up the tomatoes and held them out for me, cupped in two hands. "Here," she said, "these are for today." We stood facing each other like this, in the middle of the still bustling market, as men lugged boxes in the periphery, stacked crates, shook onion skins from burlap bags, called out to each other, as small birds clamored and pecked for seeds, as the sound of the metal grates could be heard closing in the distance. The day was done. She held the fruit in two cupped hands, and I placed my two hands beneath hers. For a moment, just us, we touched. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about us at between-bites.com and follow us on social media as Between Bites.